this is a lot of the reasons that it gets misdiagnosed, because it's overlooked. But then when we're actually looking at treating these symptoms, there's a lot of commonly mistreated radiculopathies. Welcome back to another episode of the Performance Rehab Authority podcast. I'm Dr. Caitlin.
And I'm Doc Raj.
And if you're not already subscribed to our channel, go ahead and do that so you can make sure that you stay up on our new episodes every week. And if you get anything out of the episodes that's particularly helpful, just pay it forward and send it to a friend. That way we can level up the profession as a whole.
So today we're going to talk about radiculopathies and radicular pain. And why is radicular pain so often misdiagnosed, missed, or just not treated well? Why do you think that is?
The lack of knowledge or the lack of the clinical skill set, I think, is one of the things, because there's the myth of if it's not numbness, tingly, or burning, it's not nerve pain.
Yeah, and then people are taught, like, hey, just clear the spine with active range of motion, or in the neck, like do a Sperlings, and if that doesn't reproduce their pain, then it's not coming from the spine, which is, it's just, that couldn't be farther from the truth, honestly. You know, we're taught that if you don't have pain below the knee, like, you don't need to look at the spine. If you don't have very clear things, like you were saying, like, it's probably not from the spine. What it comes down to is most PTs honestly don't know how to effectively identify those things without it being super obvious along the way. It's difficult to pick up on, because you have to know, like, all the cues to look at the spine, right? So, like, what red flags or pain patterns or mechanisms or lack of mechanisms might indicate that it's the spine. Like hamstring pain, tightness after just being on your feet all day. Like, that's not normal, right? Like, that should be a big question mark in your brain if you're constantly feeling the need to, like, stretch the hamstrings.
That's a huge one.
Yeah, or if someone's like, I just feel so tight, and they're, like, doing this kind of a thing to stretch all the time. Like, that's also huge. Anybody that's, like, hypermobile that says they feel tight, like, that should be a little red flag of, like, probably got some spine stuff going on. You know, if they get relief of their pain somewhere in their legs from a tall sitting, like, perched on a bar stool with their feet on the ground, like, that's weird, right? Like,
Yeah, I think those are all instances where our PT ears should really perk up when we start hearing things like that. We talked in another episode about, like, buzzwords or buzz phrases to look for. But really, this is a lot of the reasons that it gets misdiagnosed, because it's overlooked. But then when we're actually looking at treating these symptoms, there's a lot of commonly mistreated radiculopathies. So what's a couple examples that you know of?
Well, I mean, it's just the neural symptoms, right? Or the neural mechanical stressors get mistreated, like neural tension testing. One, most people, not I hesitate to say most people, but a lot of people, when I look at how they're doing neural tension testing, most of the time, they're not doing a great job at it. They're missing some key points and key components, and they're missing how to interpret the findings of those tests as well. You know, we're taught, or a lot of us are taught, if you're doing a neural tension test, and the only way that it's positive is if it's a reproduction of their symptoms, right? And that's not the case. Neural tension testing, you're just looking for asymmetries. If you have a sensation of tightness on one side, like, oh, I get tightness in my forearm here, and on the other side, you can go all the way down to a straight elbow before it happens, that's a neural tension sensitivity that needs to be addressed. But then also taking that and being able to look at the neural tension mechanical stressor and understand whether the nerve is actually adhered or not. Whenever I've asked somebody, why are you doing neural flossing? The answer is to improve the mobility of the nerve, right? Like, that's the point. So improve the neurodynamics and improve the ability of the nerve to slide around in the sheath and all that stuff. But then you ask, how do you know it's stuck and not moving well? And the answer is, well, because they have a positive tension test. That does not tell you that the nerve is not moving well. What that tells you is they're sensitive to getting a nerve stretched. What tells you if the nerve is not moving well is when you test for an adhesion, right? And an adhesion will prevent the nerve from moving. But if you can give from one end and take from another, then it can't be adhered. If I use my sweater here, and we get into this position where I create tension here, and I can give some slack and take it on the other end and give some slack, and vice versa, then it can't be adhered. And the problem isn't that the nerve is moving well, because we're moving it along that way. So understanding how to actually interpret a lot of these findings is often just not known by a lot of therapists, because they weren't taught.
I think another one is confusing flexion sensitivity to any load sensitivity. So for instance, a lot of people like their repeated lumbar flexion test, right? So if somebody is load sensitive, that test might be positive. And if they're flexion sensitive, that test might be positive. You can also confuse the two. So if you have somebody bend forward and they're not flexion sensitive, but they're load sensitive, it's going to be positive, but then they can curl into a ball without pain. So they can flex the spine pain-free, not in a loaded position, but then when they're standing up and they bend forward, it's painful.
Clarity, when she says curl into a ball, she means in the sideline, fetal position. So somebody can bend forward, they have pain, but you get them in sideline, they can curl into a ball in sideline, which is a non-loaded position, it's totally fine. It cannot be a flexion sensitivity.
And so then we have all these people that are going down that train of thought that it's like, oh, well, you know, they're flexion sensitive, but once we get them out of pain, what we need to do is just load them up on Jefferson curls because they haven't loaded the spine enough, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
Jefferson curls is a hot topic, right? I want to segue down that a little bit, because the Jefferson curls loads the spine in flexion. And if you look at any studies, the mechanism of injury for a herniated disc is load plus flexion repetitively over time. I think that there's a utility for the Jefferson curl, right? When somebody is afraid of movement, like you shouldn't have to brace your spine to pick a barbell up off the ground. And somebody that's super afraid and fear avoidant, you can use that as a teaching tool. But I don't think it's something that you should be loading up anyways, right? Because if we're looking at loading and increasing load, then we should be teaching appropriate spinal mechanics and bracing and things like that, because it is important the way that you lift. Otherwise, nobody would ever have to worry about the form and everybody would just pick up weights and everybody would be totally fine, but that's just not how it works. We see people every single day that when we fix the biomechanics of how they're lifting, that's what actually gets them out of pain. And a lot of them were told by other people to do Jefferson curls, and that's actually keeping them in pain because they have that load sensitivity that they haven't respected. Like a sprained ankle, right? If you sprain your ankle, what do? You maybe get some crutches. You get maybe an air cast, right? You keep some weight off it. You give it a period of time where it can actually heal, and you leave it alone a little bit. And then as it progresses through the phases of healing, then you can start loading and stretching and doing that stuff as appropriate. But what happens if you do it too early? You just create more pain. And it's not confusing when it comes to the ankle, but people lose their minds when it comes down to the spine. And a lot of it's because they don't have the clarity around the mechanical stressors and what they mean, and they can't parse out between, well, is it load sensitive or is it flexion sensitive? Because if you have a load sensitive patient, when they bend forward into flexion, immediately as soon as you bend forward, you're at 150% of your body weight on your spine. If they keep bending all the way forward and they get do like a toe touch and their pain decreases, that's because now that flexion becomes unloaded. Like, that's not a flexion sensitivity, it's load. And if you have them doing planks and side planks and loaded carries and squats and lifts, like, and you're causing more compression, you're probably making things worse. But it gets real sticky here because the spine doesn't immediately give you pain feedback all the time, right? It's more like a credit card. You can go swipe your credit card for 40, 50 bucks. It's not a big deal. You can probably do it a lot before it becomes a big deal. You don't feel the pain right in that moment. You feel it when you check your balance later on, when you get a bill in the mail, right? The retail therapy part of it, when you're at the mall online or you're on Amazon, just buying a bunch of stuff because you're in a bad mood and it makes you feel better. You get those little hits of dopamine and stuff. It feels good in the moment, but in long term, it keeps you in pain because now you have that debt you have to pay off.
And so I think that leads into another one of the commonly mistreated things is lack of understanding of pain generators with the delayed onsets of pain.
Yeah.
Just like Roger was talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could be doing these things in the clinic that feel good, but then you get a message from your patient, or maybe you don't if you work in the insurance world. They come into the next appointment and they're like, oh man, I was in pain for days afterwards. It wasn't right then. It was the next day, or it was later that night. And you're like, well, it wasn't me. It had to be something you did. But actually, it might have been you if you don't have an understanding of how these things work. Oftentimes, people need to look at what they've done hours earlier in the day. When people are like, I have a lot of pain, and it doesn't make any sense because I'm doing nothing, and I have a lot of pain. Sometimes I can do a lot, and I have no pain. It's because they don't understand mechanical stressors either. When you're doing nothing, like you're doing something. Nothing could be sitting watching TV, and if you have a load-sensitive patient, and they're sitting in a position that puts them at 185% of their spine, like, that's a whole lot of something they're doing, right? Like, if you're sleeping, if you're a human and you're alive, you're in a position, there's forces on your bodies, you're existing, there is no such thing as doing nothing that doesn't have an effect on the spine.
So this all poses the question, because that's how things are commonly mistreated. It poses the question of, so how do I create a plan?
Yeah, I mean, you have to identify the mechanical stressors appropriately. The mechanical stressors are the things that stress the spine mechanically, that it's sensitive to, that cause pain, right? So if we look at another example of that real quick, a stenotic patient. If you have a stubborn old man, stenotic patient, that can't stand up tall, and they want to stand up tall, but it creates more pain, so they slouch a little bit. But even when they're standing for a period of time, slouching, it starts to hurt. And then they sit down, and it feels better for a period of time, and then it starts to hurt again. What's the mechanical stressor there? Well, it's a combination, right? They're extension sensitive when they're standing. They're an extension. When they sit, it puts them in flexion, but it also increases the load. So it alleviates the extension pain, but then over time, that load builds up and then becomes sensitive to loading. Just like if I hung out here long enough, this doesn't hurt right now because of my wrist, but eventually it would start to hurt, right? We have to understand those things, and we have to help them create an environment within their body that's actually conducive to healing by walking through their day, understanding exactly what they're doing throughout their day, and helping them understand the mechanical stressors and how to modify how they're doing the things that they don't think about doing all throughout their day, which could be how they're getting out of bed, how are they putting their pants on, how are they putting their shoes on, how is their car set up, how are they giving their kid a bath, what position are they in when they're cooking? How are they unloading the dishwasher? What does doing laundry look like? How about vacuuming, sweeping, playing with the kids, the stuff at work? All of these things we have to look at and help them modify how they're doing it so we can actually create an environment within the body that's conducive to healing. Just like if you have credit card debt, you have to stop spending money in all of the different areas. You can't just stop buying Starbucks and expect that to make a huge difference in your financial situation.
Yeah. So on top of all of this, like, we're creating that environment. They have to understand it. They have to be doing it 24 hours a day, because if not, they're not following your advice. And we also have to look at the mobility and stability limitations that are contributing to their mechanical stressors.
That's the above and the below thing, right? Like, if someone has a low back issue and they have some thoracic mobility issues, restrictions, and they have some hip restrictions, well, if you think about having a chain link and the things at the top, a link of chain, right, whatever, some chains with links, right? It's rusted at the top the first few, and it's rusted at the bottom the last few. Like, what's going to happen to the ones in the middle? They're going to have to move a lot more and make up that slack, and then what's going to happen? They're going to wear down. You'll have some issues there. Or even looking further, if somebody does a lot of overhead work, and let's say they're an electrician and they have an extension-sensitive low back pain, and every time they go overhead, they extend their low back like this. We need to be able to look at, hey, how's their shoulder range of motion? What's restricting that? Is that lat? Is it thoracic spine? Is it motor control? How do we develop an exercise regimen that's actually specific to maintaining lumbar position away from extension while we move them into these positions over and over and over and over and over and over again, because that's what they have to do in life. We also have to take this, though, and empower patients to continue to move and not just look at, like, hey, here's all of this shit you can't do, you need to be super careful, blah 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 blah, right? Because that's how you get into scaring the shit out of patients and being nocebic and having them become fear avoidant. So we need to be empowering them along the same lines to stay active, to stay in the gym, and helping them develop a list of the things that they can and should be doing, which also needs to outweigh the list of things that they shouldn't be doing, right? If we have a list that's this big of things they can't do, we should be coming up with a list of this big of things that they can and should be doing and helping empower them. right?
Yeah. Even if we're modifying activities for a few weeks, we have to make sure that they have more than enough that they can still go out and hit it hard in the gym within the confines of their mechanical stressors. Like, they still have to be able to move. For so many people, a lot of the active adults that come in, movement and training is also a mental health component of, like, keeping people sane, like managing anxiety or managing all the extra energy that they get throughout the day. And they need that as an outlet. So if you take that away, you need to be replacing it with some sort of other activity.
Yeah, and it's like, you don't tell them stop exercising, stop doing this, whatever. It's like, hey, if they need to take a break from running, because running, every time they run, it creates more pain, and it would be in their best interest to take a small break, make a deal with them, right? Like, hey, listen, I want to get you back to running as fast as we possibly can with zero pain. And they're like, I want that too. Cool, now you're on the same page. Sometimes the fastest way to do that is to take a little break from the thing so you can get back to it without having pain even faster. It might take you an extra 6 weeks to get back to it if every time you run, you're hurting your ankle again. And if we just give it that little bit of time to actually heal up front, we can do some good work. We can get you back to running much faster. Can we take a 2 week break and see how it feels? And I'm like, oh man, I really don't want to. But yep, but instead, we're going to have you doing aerodyne intervals. We're going to have you swimming. We're going to have you, you know, hitting the rower. We're going to have you squatting, whatever it is, working upper body, something to replace that stimulus. And we're going to give that to them, right? We're going to make that important to them as well.
So that goes into, like, making sure that we're setting clear expectations from the beginning and all throughout rehab. So what their role is, what they're going to be doing, and then exactly what we're prescribing. So telling them, okay, these are how you manage your mechanical stressors. Are we still managing them, you know, weeks down the line? We're giving them that information every time so that they know exactly what their job is.
And then, like, also diving into the specifics of, like, if you have somebody that's a little bit flexion sensitive and they flex forward when they're squatting because they're lacking dorsiflexion, like, hey, maybe they can keep squatting if they just elevate their heels, right? But then bringing it back to setting clear expectations of, like, what does the timeline look like? How long am I going to have to do this for? When can I start to get back to these things? And setting the expectation that they're going to have a flare-up. Because when you set that expectation, and then they have the flare-up, and you tell them, I think I told you we're going to have this conversation, it instantly diffuses the whole situation. If you don't set the expectation that they're going to have a flare-up, you know, here's exactly how I do it, right? I say, hey, you're going to come in at some point, and you're going to be like, this isn't working. It's worse than it was at the beginning. And you're going to be super frustrated, right? And then we're going to dig in, and we're going to find that you haven't had pain for like 8, 9, 10, 14 days at all. And then you haven't been paying any attention. So then you just kind of overdid it because you weren't actually paying attention to the mechanical stressors because you were feeling good. Then I'll remind you that we had this conversation. I told you this was going to happen. And you'll be like, oh, that's right. You did tell me. And you'll take care of it for a day or two. And you'll be over the hump. And you'll be good to go from there. And then when they come in, all I say is like, hey, remember that conversation where I told you this was going to happen? And they're like, oh, shit, you did. And like, that is it. I don't have to deal with their emotions being super high, like, because I'm an expert, right? I just predicted the future for them. And if they don't have it, great. They're not going to come back and be like, well, you told me I was going to have a flare-up. Like, yeah, well, that's why I tell you that in the beginning. And so hopefully when you're feeling good, you continue to be aware of it. Because pain does not dictate the health of the nervous system, period. And that's where a lot of people lose this. That's where insurance loses the game. That's where a lot of therapists lose the game because they're so focused on pain. That's why people get stuck in the endless pain cycle because they only take care of things until they are out of pain.
If pain were the predictor of the health of the nervous system, then when people are out of pain, they could start ignoring all the mechanical stressor pain and they wouldn't have flare-ups.
Yeah, I mean, so what is it that dictates the health of the nervous system? Like, how do you know when you can not have to be so careful, not be so aware of things anymore? Well, the answer to that is your neuroscreen. The reflexes that most people don't like to check, that tells you a lot about the health of the nervous system. The myotomal strength deficits, the ability of that nerve to tolerate being stretched, those are all the things that we want to see normalize and get back to baseline, right? Symmetrical. Then we can start playing with things and pushing it along. If you start pushing this stuff along and you haven't seen myotomal strength increases, they're not able to tolerate more stretch of the nerve and their reflexes aren't starting to normalize, it's too soon and you're missing the boat and you're like, that's what's going to put them back into pain. Patients do that themselves all the time. Look at their up and down throughout the day. When they don't understand, like when it hurts, they don't do it. The second that it stops hurting, they start doing the thing again, whatever the thing is, and then it puts them back in pain, and they're just in that cycle all day, every day. As you go through the phases of healing, it's the same cycle, just on a larger scale, right? Instead of volume in a single training workout, it's volume throughout a phase, volume throughout a week, throughout a month, throughout the entire phase of training that you're in. It doesn't, with the spine, it doesn't really go out to a month, but you know, it's too much at one time. It's too much within a couple of hours. It's too much in a day. It's too much over the last couple of days. And that's where people have a hard time because they've been feeling good for days and they stop paying attention.
So I hope all of that helps encapsulate why radiculopathies get missed, why they get mistreated, and then it gives you a foundation for how you should go about treating it, at least in an order of things to look for. So that being said, we do have a free 3-week mini course if you're interested in leveling up as a clinician. Just go to moveathleticseducation.com/free, or you can click the link in the description box below.
It actually teaches how to, one of the first things it digs into is how to pick up on some spine-generated pain that maybe isn't super clear. There's the exact process that we use in there to regionalize and let you know that you need to get into looking at the spine or not.
And remember, if you're unhappy or unfulfilled in your life or in your career, it is up to you. No one is coming to save you. It's your responsibility to lead by example, to pursue excellence and to learn new skills.
Yeah, and to welcome the challenge, right? The challenge of raising the bar, not just for you, but for everybody around you. Drive the change that you want to see.